afternoon, everyone, and welcome to another edition of Memories and Music, brought to you every Sunday at this time on CIGM FM Stereo by Inco Metals Company Limited. Before we get to our first musical selection, here's Gary Peck with an introduction to today's guest.
I'm Gary Peck, your host on Memories and Music, presented Sunday at 1 p.m. by Inco Metals Company. This week, my guest will be Art Carr, a resident of Palmerston, Ontario, and we'll be talking about two of Sudbury's major newspapers, the Sudbury Star, still operating today, of course, and the Sudbury Journal, in operation from 1891 until 1919. Art Carr was associated with both of those newspapers during the early 1920s and shortly before. Welcome to the interview portion of Memories and Music. Art Carr, a resident of Palmerston, Ontario, is our guest today. Mr. Carr was born September 17, 1912, in Sudbury, and Mr. Carr, you've been associated with the newspaper industry, I would say, virtually all of your life. And I'd like to deal with that or work on that aspect of your interest and involvement on this program today. Mr. Carr, before we get into that aspect of it, though, I'd like you to share with us some biographical information in terms of who your parents were, what line of work was your father in, etc.
Yes, Gary. You know, we're supposed to be into a depression at this time, or a recession. And it seems back about 1906, there was a terrific recession in Britain. And even in those days, the building trades were the first ones that were hit. If we have time, I'd like to tell you that we didn't have refrigeration in 1906. And beef was shipped to Britain from Canada, alive, in special boats, known as cattle boats. And the Salvation Army, seeing those boats come back to Canada empty, thought this was a bit of a mistake. So they'd flush them out with fire hoses, hang hammocks in the stalls. Areas that had been used for bedding and food storage would be used for dining halls and recreational centers. And they offered very cheap passage to these victims of the 1906 depression. And they guaranteed to find young men work in Canada. My father took advantage of that in his 20s. Docked at Halifax, stood before the man's desk. The man said to him, "And what do you do?" "I'm a bricklayer." He checked his list and said, "Bricklayers are needed in Sudbury," and gave my dad a ticket to Sudbury.
You gave your dad that information in Halifax?
In Halifax.
Your father's name was?
Bert Carr.
Bert Carr. And came over from England?
Yes, a little village, Lane End, in Buckinghamshire, close to the larger center of High Wycombe.
He came to Sudbury, he came to Canada, rather. Was he by himself?
By himself. He came to Canada with many other young Brits at that time. I can remember quite a few of them, I could name them. But they found work in Sudbury. There were carpenters, plumbers, masons. And they bought lots in a newly opened, I'll call it a subdivision. And so many of them flocked to that little area where the CPR tracks leave Sudbury heading west that I believe that area is still known today as Little Britain.
Yes, it is.
And, of course, houses in those days had woodsheds. So these young fellows helped each other, and they built the woodshed of what would be their permanent home. And they lived in that woodshed, saved their money, went back to Britain, married their girlfriends. In my father's case, it was one, Mary Meeks, and brought them back to Canada. This time, of course, traveling not on cattle boats,
no,
but on the liners, as they were known in those days. I know my mother came over on the Duchess of Athol and told us frequently of her experiences. And they settled in this area in Britain. And they begat five children, two daughters, followed by one boy, myself, and then two daughters. And that was their family. And although I have no recollection of living in Little Britain, the family had moved to Kathleen Street, just off the top of College Street, and that is the world as I first knew it, that little area.
Now, we mentioned at the onset that your involvement has been in association with the newspaper industry. What was the beginning like?
I think the beginning was my fascination with complex machinery. And the Sudbury Star at that time was printed in two places, would you believe? The type was set on the corner of what is now the corner of Elm and Monk, I believe. There was a lane ran down the back of the property and ended at the Grand Theater. And the press room was in the basement of the Grand Theater. And they carried the forms, winter and summer, rain or shine, these heavy lead typeset forms, down this lane to the press and printed it there. And there were windows, and passers-by could see this old cylinder press operating and see the folder running. And I think that is what first sparked my interest.
As a youngster, you would see that as you were walking.
Oh, yes. There was a pipe railing that you could lean on and watch these machines. Mm-hmm. And there was a girl running the press, and she always had one foot on the impression pedal in case she missed a sheet. And she always stood there with one shoe off. And I don't know whether it was this strip act centered on one shoe, mm-hmm. the left one, that attracted it or not, but small boys would always ponder, why one shoe off?
Big questions to answer.
Yes.
At that age. Now, you came to Palmerston, rather, I believe, in the 1930s, was it?
1934, April the 1st.
Now, what did you become involved with the Palmerston Observer at that time?
Oh, yes.
In what capacity?
In a small town weekly newspaper, you have no set capacity.
No.
You do everything.
Mm-hmm.
You run the linotype, you run the press, you sweep the floor, and you clean the kitchen sink, which is all you have for a wash basin.
Mm-hmm.
And a general knowledge of the entire operation would be necessary to be a valued employee in a weekly. Now, there's quite a story about this. The Globe and Mail operated a Sunday bureau at that time, which consisted of one newspaper man, Eddie Gigg. And Eddie was quite a friend of mine, because Eddie found it impossible to be two places at once. And Eddie would ask me to go out and cover something, a hockey game. I believe a Rotary Club was operating then, a Rotary meeting. And I would get $3 for about 5 hours' work. But $3 was big money. I was also earning money playing in a dance band, and I was quite happy. But there was an ad in the Globe and Mail that Eddie spotted, where a small town weekly wanted a general all-around, Joe Boy. And Eddie phoned to tell me about it. Failing to contact me, he told my mother. My mother insisted that I answer this ad, but I didn't want to. So I obfuscated for 2 days, which was certainly sufficient time to lose the job, mm-hmm. which I definitely wanted to do. But however, mother practically stood over me with a bludgeon and compelled me to reply. So I wrote a great detailed list of my qualifications as printer, newspaper person. No one in their right mind would have believed it. But what I didn't know was that I was writing to a dear old lady who knew nothing of printing. And she thought I must be next to the Lord.
Mm-hmm.
And I got the job, though I was competing with no less than 379 other applicants. About 6 months after I arrived in Palmerston, they allowed me to check through and destroy 379 other letters.
So you had your involvement at that time really was all-encompassing. You really had experience in a number of areas once you arrived in Palmerston. You had to gain experience in certain areas.
Oh, yes. Looking back on it, it's rather odd.
Mm-hmm.
I was a linotype operator. That in itself.
You had training in that.
Oh, yes. I had actually been a linotype operator in daily newspapers. I had laid out and sold display advertising. I had been actually shop foreman with a gang of about 11 printers working in my direction.
So that experience would serve you well when you came to Palmerston.
Oh, yes.
Some of that. Now, Mr. Carr, also you became the owner, or the publisher-editor, rather, of the Palmerston Observer.
Well, you must remember that the world was still staggering in the dirty 30s. The Palmerston Spectator had had failed, and it had been restarted as the Palmerston Observer. I came to work for the people who had then been in business for 1 year. They lasted another 2 years, and it was picked up by another man. The Observer was picked up by the late A. Ross Harkness, who came to Palmerston from the Toronto Daily Star. He had been on staff at the Sudbury Star and married his wife, one of the Pollock family, also off Kathleen Street. And he was here 2 years, and he failed. Now, in the meantime, I had got married, and I had 1 1/3 children. There were no jobs to be had. I've now got you up to 1938, Gary. Mm-hmm. There were no jobs to be had. A delegation of the merchants came to me to see if I could salvage this bankrupt newspaper. 5 men in town guaranteed my credit for $100 each, businessmen. My father backed my note for $500 between these merchants and the bank. And with that borrowed $500, I made a down payment on the equipment. Mm-hmm. And in September of 38, became editor-publisher of the Palmerston Observer.
Now, that brought us to 38. I'd like to jump up to, was it 1977 when you sold the paper?
Yes.
What's your involvement? What's it been like since 1977? For example, I took up the Listowel Banner of this past week, and there's the headline on the front page, Arthur Carr named OCNA Life Member, Ontario Community Newspapers Association. So you're quite involved in other areas as well. Now, in terms of television, I believe you have a program, a regular program.
When I retired, I wanted to keep a low profile. I didn't want my successor, sort of, should I say, this sounds egotistical, and of course I am that. I didn't want him walking in my shadow. So I needed something to do. Mm-hmm. We had a little cable system serving 5 towns. So I got the newspapers from those 5 towns and did a little weekly resume of the weekly news. After 2 years of that, I wondered if I couldn't spread my wings a bit farther. So I dropped the cable system and went to CKCO-TV in Kitchener. And they bought the deal. And for almost 2 years, I have been their country editor. Mm-hmm. I guess it must be getting close to 80 weekly newspapers. And I spend 16 hours at least every week preparing a 3-minute televised spot talking about little odd sods and clods, crazy little things that happen in the small towns. Would you like a sample?
Mm-hmm. Yes, I think that would be appropriate.
Well, the...
Not 3 minutes worth, though.
The Cambridge Alive, a little community newspaper, sent one of their people out to the school to interview grade 3 students as to what to do with all this snow. How will we ever get rid of it? And they interviewed a half a dozen youngsters and had lovely pictures of the kiddies. One little boy suggested that we get a fire truck, the ladder of which would reach to the sun. And then we could polish the sun with easy off. It would shine so much brighter that it would melt all the snow. End of story. But I tell about 5 of those mm-hmm. every Saturday night.
Popular program, I'm sure. You really haven't retired. You've just, your interests are now in different areas, though still related to journalism.
Oh, I hope I never retire fully.
I gather that. We're going to have to take a break right now. I'll turn the program over to Doug McLaughlin, our music host. When we return, perhaps we could talk about some of the early newspapers in Sudbury. First, we'll hear from Doug McLaughlin. Today on Memories and Music, our guest is Art Carr. Mr. Carr, you've had a lifetime of interest and involvement with the newspaper industry, and one of the early involvements was associated with the Sudbury Star, I believe, and the Sudbury Journal. But you began with the Star?
Oh, yes.
In what capacity? And what period of time are we talking about?
We're talking about 1925, what we call then the summer holidays.
13 years of age,
yes. I got the job as General Joe Boy, sweeping the floor, running around with proofs, and delivering printed products. For instance, I can recall that liquor laws had changed, and the beer labels for Silver Foam, made by Sudbury Brewing and Malting out on the Coppercliff Road. And they had a little tiny line at the foot of the label, guaranteed not over 4.4%. Now it was necessary to block that line out. And I delivered hundreds of pounds of beer labels from the Sudbury Star to the brewery on my bicycle and brought back other labels which would be processed.
Which would be altered.
Yes. Mm-hmm. One of the earliest jobs I can remember.
Mm-hmm. The Sudbury Star had been in operation for, I think it would be 4 years at that time, commencing in 1909. So you were there during its early existence.
Yes.
And Mr. Mason was...
Yes, Mr. Mason, incidentally, was born in Walkerton, not mm-hmm. too far from us today.
No.
And he went to Sudbury, and I understand the man that employed him was losing ground rapidly. An alcoholic, I believe, I've heard it said. Mm-hmm. Bill Mason's mother died in Walkerton. And Bill got $200 from his mother's estate. And he used that as a down payment to buy the then derelict Sudbury Star. And by sheer impact of personality and hard work, I'll say, Bill Mason developed an empire that you people probably remember. Mm-hmm. A lot of Sudbury folks will burst into profanity at the mere mention of the man's name. But I held a certain amount of respect for him.
Respect as a 13-year-old or respect later in life? How did you view him as a 13-year-old, for example?
I think I liked him. Bill had no children. And I believe that I was sort of a surrogate son, if you know what I mean. Mm-hmm. I didn't realize it then. But I know that he took an interest in me that one wouldn't expect from a man with the worries of the Grand Theater, mm-hmm. the Sudbury Star, the North Bay Nugget, and the Sudbury Transit Company on his mind. And when he would shove his glasses up onto his forehead and stick his lower lips out because he had taken his dentures out because they were uncomfortable, and stand scowling in the middle of the composing room floor, I could nearly always get a smile. Mm-hmm. And I felt close to the man. And he told me many things, because he also employed me as a chauffeur. And I would drive him to Toronto, I would drive him to North Bay, or just around the city.
You recall what kind of car he had at that time?
Oh, yes. A great big President 8 Studebaker with freewheeling. A marvelous car. It took 32 gallons to fill the gas tank, and it got about 4 miles to the gallon.
How long would it take you to drive to North Bay?
Less than 2 hours, mm-hmm. on a gravel road. The pavement ended at Coniston. The highway speed was 35 miles an hour. And you were lucky if the road was straight enough, because in those days it literally went around trees.
Mm-hmm. How long did you work for the Star? It was a fairly short period of time, was it not?
Yes, in
matter
years.
Of months?
A matter of years.
Matter of years.
Yes. I think I was a nuisance. They started me in the job department. Down in the basement. I learned to run the presses, run the paper cutter. And in my youthful ego, which has never quite left me, I soon felt I knew everything there. And I agitated to get into the composing room proper. I succeeded. After a few months there, I wanted to get onto a linotype. I couldn't. Roy Gilpin smashed his hand in the press room. And Roy was off for weeks. And I agitated and got into the press room, filling in and learned how to run their old whole web press, which produced 24 pages, a maximum. And we printed twice a week, Wednesdays and Saturdays. Then when Roy came back, I was back in the composing room, agitating to become a linotype operator. Meanwhile, I was pestering the boys in the editorial office and getting a bit of rewrite to do, getting to cover the odd police court, and doing also editorial room work. When it seemed that there was obstructionism, as I viewed it, not allowing me to become a linotype operator, in a petulant huff, I quit.
How old were you?
I would be 15 then, I think. Mm-hmm. At know-it-all age, you know. So, terrified to go home and tell Mother, I jumped the job. I walked down the street and I appealed to W.J. Cressy in the Journal Printing Company. I can remember it was about 10:45 in the morning, and I was able to go home and tell Mother that I was going to work at 1 o'clock at the Journal.
Did you not have to be in school at that time?
No, because when I joined the Star Staff as a summer holiday help, as September 1st approached, I happened to be have my Mr. Mason's attention focused on me, and he said something like this, "I guess we'll be losing you, boy." And I said, "Yes, damn it." And he said, "Would you like to stay?" And I said, "I'd love to stay." So Bill Mason, publisher of the Sudbury Star, wrote a letter to Bill Mason, chairman of the Sudbury School Board, the same person, explaining that this kid would learn more in the printing office than he would taking the 3-year industrial course, of which he had completed 1 year in Sudbury's new technical school, because the Sudbury Technical School was brand new in those days.
So
it was a pioneer in what we call trades or vocational training today.
So with that letter, really the newspaper industry became your school in a sense. You didn't have to go back to Sudbury.
Oh, yes. I can recall when I left school, I was a terrible speller. Mm-hmm. And arithmetic was absolutely foreign to me. But I learned.
Had to learn. We're going to take a break at this point. We'll turn the program back to Doug McLaughlin. When we return, we'll talk a little bit more about the Sudbury Star. Welcome back to the interview portion of our program today. Art Carr is our guest. We've been talking about the early days of the Sudbury Star. Mr. Carr, when you commenced working with the Sudbury Star in 1913, where was the Star located?
1913, Gary, 1925.
1925, yes.
I was only a year old.
That's right.
In 13.
Precocious, but not that precocious. 1925.
Yes, Gary. Well, I have many memories. One of them is being the copy boy in the composing room of the Sudbury Star while I was still in short pants, as we called them then, stovepipe pants.
Right.
And the copy boy had to get the copy, as the name would indicate, from the editorial office. And these were printed on little sheets of, or typed on little sheets of paper, known as takes, each sheet being a take. There may be up to a dozen takes in a lengthy story. You distributed these to the typesetting machine. Then you also got the headings from the head writer, took it to the machine that could handle that size of heading. And then when the type was set, you assembled it all. And of course, you had the makeup man on your back continually to get production moving. You were his bottleneck. And I recall one day standing behind Alan Baker, who was the heading writer. Alan was short, thick-set, Germanic, and I think the family name was Barr before the war. They changed it to Baker. I think Alan was born at Blind River. And Alan has this piece of paper in his hand. And he has written WCTU. I'd never seen that combination before. And I said, "Alan, WCTU, what does that indicate?" And using his pencil for emphasis, striking the paper, he said, "Arthur, they're a group of people that are afraid that sometime, somewhere, someplace, someone's going to have some fun. And by God, they're going to stop it." Now, through the years, I, of course, had many dealings with the WCTU. And while I realize that they are a deterrent and a governing factor, and we need them, I have become more and more through the years to appreciate Alan Baker's analysis.
And his comments remained in your memory.
Oh, yes, not just his comments. It's a videotape, mm-hmm. and I can rerun it at the push of a button mm-hmm. and see him in full living color.
When you were working with the Star, how many would there be in the building? How many would be working there?
If you took everyone, administrative staff, through to our janitorial services, probably 25. Maybe 30.
25 or 30 at that time.
Yes.
The Star was located...
at the corner of Monk and Elm.
Monk and Elm. And the printing presses, did you say, were located in the Grand?
In the earlier...
Basement of the Grand?
Before they got a rotary or web-fed press, it was a flatbed press and a folder, still used by a few weeklies today. And it was in the basement of the Grand Theater building. And it was rather peculiar structure. with kind of a walkway, a below-level entrance. The type was set in the first location indicated, and the heavy forms of lead, made of lead-type metal, were carried rain and shine, summer and winter, down the lane and across the street and into the basement of the Grand, where the presses and folding and mailing equipment were located, and the final production stages were made there. Then, of course, as the Star grew, it obtained through a distress sale this used press. And there was a frantic flurry of activity while the building firm Hugh Barlow and Son constructed a press room. And it was a day and night thing because Bill Mason was paying demurrage on two CPR boxcars loaded with press parts. So it was a frantic hurry.
There was an incentive there to get completed. The Star came out twice a week?
Yes, Wednesdays and Saturdays.
Wednesdays and Saturdays. Where would one purchase a copy of the paper? In the hotels? What other sites?
Oh, there were newsstands. Jerry Krogan had a newsstand opposite the post office. I'm sure there are people who will remember Jerry. He was a real Irishman, quite a wit. Cigarette lighters, the old Storm King had just come in then. I can recall being in Jerry's one day when a fellow came in and said, "Jerry, do you carry spare parts for these Storm King lighters?" "Certainly." He said, "Give me a couple of thumbs."
Welcome back to the interview portion of Memories and Music, the concluding section of the program today. Our guest has been Art Carr. The topic has been the Sudbury Star during the early 1920s. Mr. Carr, Nettie Magder, I believe, was one individual who you recall with a degree of fondness, association with the newspaper.
Oh, yes, there are so many of them, Gary. But I think if I were going to select someone that was outstanding, I would have to name Nettie. She was what we called in those days a sob sister, and she was very early into it. And Nettie was a fully accredited journalist. And she was one of the journalistic crew on the Royal Train in 1939, traveling Canada from coast to coast with our King and Queen. I can't think of a more signal honor for a woman at that time, because we didn't have women's lib the way we have it today.
No. For what newspaper was she writing at that time?
I'm not certain of
no.
this, but I believe it was Canadian Press, but I'm not really certain. Mm-hmm. And of course, there are many others went through. A. Ross Harkness, who wrote the book Atkinson of the Star, he was quite famous. And of course, J.Y. Nicol. Why, Gary, you couldn't list a dozen top flight newspaper people or journalists in Canada and omit the name of Nicol. There were so many people. Why, Gordon Sinclair did a stint on the Sudbury Star.
What attracted them to Sudbury? Why were they there? Did they begin there?
Well, no. Whether it was Bill Mason's attempt, and largely successful, to attract good brains. Mm-hmm. He had some type of magnetism that brought good people to him.
He was that confident of himself that he wasn't afraid of surrounding himself with competent people.
Why, he fought with these people. I mean, he rowed with them continually, but they seemed to enjoy it. Why, Jimmy Nicol and Mason had a fist fight right in the front foyer of the building. And we all clustered around cheering, you know. We knew that Mason, in his ego, would think we were cheering for him, and we knew that Nicol would know damn well we were cheering for him, so our cheers were not restrained.
In order to be successful in the newspaper industry, you were indicating that one had to be fired from a few newspapers.
Oh, yes. To be fired by the Sudbury Star and the Toronto Star. Why, if you were applying for a job, you wrote that in
your application. That was on your curriculum vitae.
That was an absolute guarantee of success. And I tell you with some pride that I was fired by both.
Yet you look back on your days with the Star, I'm sure, with fond memories.
Oh,
I sense that from our interview.
Oh, absolutely, Jerry.
We're going to have to end our program at that point. On behalf of our listening audience, Mr. Carr, thank you very much. I'm sure that everyone has found the interview today most fascinating, and certainly we'll be back again with another story. Thank you.
Memories and Music is presented every Sunday at 1 o'clock on CIGM FM Stereo by Inco Metals Company Limited.